You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Barrett. Wisconsin's elections this week were officially nonpartisan. If you've been listening to WPR, you've heard about 5 trillion times that means that candidates don't run under a party label, like Democrat or Republican or the rest. But you may have noticed subtle signs that there's some partisan political involvement, like massive donations or ad campaigns from the state Democratic and Republican parties and from major donors on the left and right, directly to candidates, to parties, or to outside groups that support candidates. A lot of that money went into the campaign for Supreme Court, but many school board races around the state saw endorsements, donations, and advertising from groups with partisan ties. So what's the deal with nonpartisan races in Wisconsin? Are they less nonpartisan than they used to be? Does it matter if they are? You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think of the heavy political angle in the state Supreme Court race? Would you like to see political parties and big donors on the left and right stay out of those kind of races? And how about school board? Did you have a politically charged campaign in your district? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Mordecai Lee has been watching Wisconsin politics for a few years now. He's an emeritus professor at UW-Milwaukee and a former state lawmaker. Mordecai, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for inviting me, Rob. Glad to be here.
Now, before we get into the nonpartisan part of this discussion, we were just talking on the show about the importance of that Supreme Court outcome. Just want to get your thoughts on that before we get into our main topic.
Well, I guess it's all about power. And up to now, power in the Supreme Court was sort of invisible because of the very topic that you introduced. That's that we elected Supreme Court justices on a nonpartisan basis. So it was harder for the voters to figure out who's the right-leaning candidate and who's the left-leaning candidate. And the breakthrough, whether it was a good precedent or a bad precedent in the race on Tuesday, was that we really easily could identify who was the left-leaning and who was the right-leaning candidate. I think there's a certain advantage to helping voters find the team that they want to vote for. I suppose the analogy would be, you know, what if at a Packer game at Lambeau Field, both teams wore the same uniform? How would we know who the Packers were and who the Bears were? So maybe the advantage of partisan elections versus nonpartisan elections is, I'm fill in the blank. I'm right-leaning. I'm conservative. Now I know who to vote for because that person's identified as Republican or, you know, on the other side. So maybe it is a service to the voters to do that. You'd have to go back to history. It's almost naive to think about the good government movement in Wisconsin about 100, 120 years ago under the La Follettes, where, you know, the theme was, let's take politics out of, and then fill in the blank, out of the spring elections, out of school board races, out of mayor's races, out of county board races. And the line they used to use in those days was, there isn't a Republican way to pick up garbage or a Democratic way to pick up garbage. There's only an efficient way to do it and a corrupt way to do it. And that really was the underlying logic of more than 100 years ago to have nonpartisan races.
Now, with a judge, say, in the Supreme Court, we could envision, and I think this is an ideal, the really impartial judge who takes the law and the precedent and the history and applies it to this issue without concern for the outcome and who it's going to make happy or make angry. Has that ever been the case? Is it naive to think that that could be a thing that we would want?
We were probably somewhat naive. Going back to when I started following Wisconsin politics in the 1960s, generally speaking, if you knew enough about the candidates and their backgrounds, you could sort of tell who was the de facto Republican and who was the de facto Democrat. But it was very, almost invisible. It was very hard to tell. I think the reason that a Supreme Court race is different from, let's say, a trial level court, circuit court, or the appeals level court, is that if you're a trial level judge or an appeals level judge, your job is to interpret the law and apply it as it's written. The famous line is, all you're doing is you're calling balls and strikes. Mm-hmm. You're not imposing your own personal views. Now, when it comes to the Supreme Court, they do get to impose their personal views because they're the ones who set precedent. They're the ones who interpret the law and decide what is the basis for making a decision? And that's where people started falling to the left or to the right. I think it was easier for us to see it on the U.S. Supreme Court when we knew that somebody who was nominated by a Democratic president was likely to be left of center, somebody named by a Republican president was likely to be right of center. And so we saw the Warren Court that sort of tipped to the left, and then we saw other courts that tipped to the right. And now it's really sort of infected Wisconsin Supreme Court politics, and even at lower levels. For those of your viewers who aren't in the Milwaukee area, we have had a Court of Appeals race, and the incumbent judge who had been named by Scott Walker was opposed by an opponent who sort of literally, almost literally said, he was named by Scott Walker, and I disagree with that. And she just killed him, almost a 2-to-1 vote, because in Milwaukee County, it's so Democratic dominated. So it's a trend. It's probably a bad trend, but it does help the voters in the long run.
I've been doing a mental exercise. Suppose somebody wanted to run for state Supreme Court as a moderate, as a down the middle, you know, old school, whatever you want to call it. I'm going to call balls and strikes. Who would they get money from? Like, where is there's not a motivated money group out there or donor or things like that that feels excited enough to give money to that versus, oh, somebody I agree with on my side, whether that's right or left. Is it impossible to have that kind of candidate be successful?
Oh, you've really hit the nail on the head, Rob. Just to play out your example, nobody would give to them except their relatives and their cousins and maybe their next door neighbors. And, you know, they'd have about $53 to spend versus the kind of millions that we saw. I suppose, based on what you just said, I think that's an argument for public financing of elections. Now, generally speaking, the taxpayers hate the idea that their tax dollars would go into politics. But if you think about it, what if the only way you could run for a state Supreme Court would be to be eligible for public financing of elections? You couldn't spend your own money. You couldn't spend anybody else's money. You were capped by the amount of money you got from the state. And your opponent was equally capped by the amount they got from the state. That would move us in the direction of what you described, but it I'm afraid it's sort of a fantasy. It's never going to happen.
We're talking about nonpartisan elections in Wisconsin, like the ones we just had, and why there seems to be a lot of partisan involvement in them these days. Issues, money, especially from state Supreme Court down to your local school board. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Let's go to your calls now. David is with us in Delavan. David, hi.
I got to grab this. Hello, how you doing?
Good. What did you want to bring up, David?
What I wanted to bring up basically is how this is, you know, this Supreme Court justice being elected is celebrated as this, you know, it's going to obviously overturn the abortion ban. And they're, you know, this is a celebration of women's rights. I, for one, am pro-choice. I see this as a dark day in Wisconsin.
Did you mean to say pro-life? If you think it's a dark day, you said pro-choice, but I think you might have meant pro-life.
I'm pro-life.
Okay,
I'm sorry.
Thanks.
Yeah, excuse me. Yeah, pro-life. And I don't know. I think, you know, so we just went through this season, Black Lives Matter, what happened in Kenosha and all this kind of stuff. Well, Planned Parenthood was founded by Margaret Thatcher, who, of course, was a racist person. And there is genocide that is taking place, you know, today, basically at the hands of these abortion clinics, with the vast number of aborted babies are African-American.
David, I gotcha. Thanks for the call. Mordecai, David, obviously not happy with the outcome. Margaret Sanger, I think David meant. But I want to take that to Janet Protasiewicz. Went closer to the line, it seems like, in expressing her views on the issue that David raises, abortion, than we usually see, at least publicly, in these Supreme Court races.
There's no doubt that she was much more explicit about the position she took on some very hot issues, including, and in particular, abortion. But I'd like to suggest that in the previous races, some of the candidates had inched closer to the line, never as close as Protasiewicz did. But, you know, they would hint, well, I'm generally conservative or I'm generally progressive. And they would sort of leave little hints and innuendos that people could interpret who was the conservative candidate and who was the liberal candidate. So she made it much more explicit. But I think we've really had that same thing to a lighter degree in Wisconsin Supreme Court races for at least 20 years.
Thanks for that call. We're talking to Mordecai Lee, emeritus professor at UW-Milwaukee, former state lawmaker, looking at nonpartisan elections in Wisconsin, like the one we just had, why they feel pretty partisan these days. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Talked a lot about the state Supreme Court. We're also going to get into school boards and want to hear a report from your part of the state. If you saw heated political school board elections where it seemed like, even though they didn't have D's and R's by their name, there were Democratic and Republican candidates. Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our talk with Mordecai Lee, emeritus professor at UW-Milwaukee, longtime observer of Wisconsin politics. We're talking about officially nonpartisan races in Wisconsin elections. We've been talking about the state Supreme Court, but there's also school boards and local government and why there's so much partisan involvement in them. Back to your calls at 800-642-1234. Steve is with us in Sun Prairie. Hi, Steve.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. So school boards, especially in rural districts, it's hard to get people to even run for a school board. And if you bring partisanship into it, it makes it even more difficult. In a small little burb of Lodi, the Columbia County Democrats decided to get involved in the election, basically endorsed two candidates, provided help for them. They had meetings inviting these candidates to them to provide support. They kicked out members of the public who were not Democrats. Do we really want this at a school board level where all kids should feel welcome? And is that a way to get more funding to schools when referendums are needed to have that much division? Doesn't make sense to me.
Steve, thanks a lot for the call. Lodi not alone. Mordecai, we saw lots of political involvement from the Democratic Party, in some cases Republican Party, and highly funded outside groups. What are you looking at there?
You know, I think something has changed. It's almost like the old model of nonpartisan school board races just absolutely cracked during COVID. In other words, up to COVID, there was sort of this general mainstream feeling that there was something called a good education, a quality education versus a lousy education or a bad school board or a micromanaging school board. And that Democrats, people who are generally Democrats and generally Republicans, just did not focus on any partisan issues. They focused on people they thought were competent and qualified and hardworking, just exactly the way Steve was describing the old model. But then all of a sudden comes along COVID, and should the school close or not close? If it's open, should they have to wear masks or not have to wear masks? And it was like from 0 to 100, it's almost like it happened overnight, that school boards got just totally swamped by parents and citizens on both sides of those issues. And suddenly school board meetings seemed like, I don't know, a state legislative meeting, you know, where people yelling and screaming at each other. And the poor school board members were just sort of hit by this tsunami of opinion. I don't know how to get back to where we were. And Steve is right. We want, these are thankless jobs. You spend night after night in meetings and reading documents in advance and making judgments if the superintendent is doing a good job or a bad job, if you need to increase taxes or not. Those are tough issues without partisanship. I'm just not sure how to get back to the good old days.
Steve, thanks for the call. And Mordecai, I've been wondering, we hear a lot about local issues being overwhelmed by national issues. We're all voting based on what we're hearing in national news and national websites. There's less local media to follow those local issues. Is that part of what's driving this? We're picking our side in national politics and writing that onto the school board level?
Well, there's no doubt that over the last 10 or 15 years that local news media, mainstream news media at the local level, you know, the local daily, the local weekly, the local radio station with a news staff, that all that has gradually faded under the pressure of financial success or bankruptcy. And so I think you're right, Rob, to hint that maybe it's been replaced by sort of national news. And both parties have really succeeded in identifying issues that can be transplanted from one state to another. For example, I think the Republicans have been very successful at creating issues such as parental rights or criticizing issues of trans students. Whether one agrees with what comes out of this right-leaning ideology or not, it's very successfully transported across municipal lines, across state lines, because an issue of, let's say, parental rights or trans rights or teaching about slavery or not teaching about slavery, those are applicable throughout the country.
Talking to Mordecai Lee, Emeritus Professor at UW-Milwaukee, looking at nonpartisan elections in Wisconsin where candidates don't run as a Republican or Democrat, say, and this goes from state Supreme Court to the school boards we've been talking about, and why there's a lot of partisan angles to them these days. I've got more callers looking at the judicial elections here. Let's go back to our callers with Cindy in Green Bay. Cindy, hi.
Hi. I would just like to say that, you know, I think everybody's partisan, but when it comes to a judge or a school board member, we should be able to expect that they are big enough to set that partisanship aside and, as far as judges go, do what's right by the law. As far as school board goes, do what's right for the children and the school and not their party. And that's part of the problem. But I think it stems from the top. And we've seen it now with the Supreme Court. They're making it partisan. It's transferring down everywhere. I just think that's how it's going to be from now on until maybe we as the people say enough is enough.
Cindy, thanks a lot for that call. She phrased that in an interesting way, Mordecai, the idea that, okay, yeah, maybe they do have a partisan lean, but when they take that position as a judge or a school board member, you know, they might lean in a certain direction, but they will be able to evaluate the law or the facts facing a school board in an objective way. I mean, that doesn't seem impossible, does it?
You know, Rob, maybe the best example is when the state Supreme Court had to make a decision about drop boxes, whether it was legal under state law for municipalities to put out drop boxes, you know, with all the security, 24-hour cameras and all that, whether it was permitted under the law. And there were two ways to interpret the silence of the law. There was nothing in the state laws that either banned drop boxes or permitted drop boxes. So the state Supreme Court justices really had to make a kind of ideological decision. A conservative approach was, if it's not explicitly permitted by the law, then it's not permitted. Whereas the sort of the right-leaning liberal justices could lean in the other direction. If it's not prohibited by state law, then it's permitted. How do you break that deadlock? How do you bring a decision that that somehow transcends those perceptions of how to make a decision? So I think it went in one direction, and maybe under a new justice, it'll go in exactly the opposite direction.
Thanks for that call, Cindy. Now, a cynical observer, Mordecai, would hear your story and say, yeah, that wasn't a reflection of their judicial thoughts on the presence or absence of a law. It was their thoughts on an outcome. One Dropbox outcome might benefit Republicans more than Democrats. The other way around. Is that fair?
You know, I think, Rob, the reason why that might be an applicable example as a predictable decision by the conservative and liberal justices is that the 4-3 vote by the conservative majority, with the exceptions of just a few cases by one Justice Hagedorn, have become so routine and so predictable and so by rote that we can only interpret that as meaning that they have a very set political ideology. And in a sense, the facts be darned, they're going to do what their partisan oriented thinking would go. And so it's 4-3, 4-3, 4-3. And now after August 1st, when she takes office, it's going to be 3-4, 3-4, 3-4. So the majority may have flipped, but the underlying predictability, I fear, has not.
Some states, have elections for state Supreme Court justices that are not nonpartisan. You run as a Republican or a Democrat for the court, or you go, I think there's one state where you go from a Republican primary, a Democratic primary, and then magically become nonpartisan. But would it be, I don't know, more honest? Would it make sense, do you think, Mordecai, for Wisconsin to switch to that system? You're an R, you're a D, you're running against each other.
You know, given these partisan times, I think maybe we should junk nonpartisan elections. Maybe we may as well do what the de facto election on Tuesday was, and that's that it was a partisan election, liberals versus conservatives. And, you know, maybe just one quick historical example. The first time that in Milwaukee, about 100 years ago, they elected a socialist mayor, it was because mayors in Milwaukee at the time were elected on a partisan basis. And the Democrats and Republicans in the state legislature didn't like that. So they united to make mayoral races nonpartisan so that it'd be harder for the voters to figure out who was the socialist. And so there was an example of sort of the major two parties thinking they would benefit by having nonpartisan elections instead of partisan ones. So it can go in either direction based on the historical momentum.
Mordecai, always good to talk to you. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Rob.
That's Mordecai Lee, emeritus professor at UW-Milwaukee, former state lawmaker. He joined us for a look at partisan politics in Wisconsin's officially nonpartisan election races, like the ones we voted in earlier this week. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, the U.S. Senate voted to end the authorization for the use of military force in Iraq from 20 years ago, which will have to go through the House and the president to become law. We'll find out what that would mean if it's repealed, the impact it's had over the last two decades. Plus, it's this week's edition of Food Friday. A Wisconsin chef shares advice on making a great fish fry at home. You can join in with your questions and suggestions. That and more coming up tomorrow here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, nonpartisan elections feel pretty partisan in Wisconsin these days. Find out why political parties are getting involved from the state Supreme Court to local school boards. Now, that same state Supreme Court will have a liberal majority for the first time in 15 years, following the election of Milwaukee County Judge Janet Protasiewicz on Tuesday in a race that set records for campaign spending. Her 10-year term on the court begins August 1st. She's likely to hear cases challenging the state's Republican-friendly political redistricting maps and the 1849 law that bans abortions. Now we have a Democratic governor, a Republican legislature, and soon a court that's expected to lean to the liberal side. So what does that mean for the future of high-profile issues here in the state? And are there clues from this week that point us toward Wisconsin's political future? You can join in at 800-642-1234. How will a liberal majority on the state Supreme Court change Wisconsin? How do you hope or fear that it could change things? What would you like to see the Republican-controlled legislature make their top priority? Do you see room for compromise between a Democratic governor and Republican lawmakers? Join in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Anthony Trigoski is an assistant professor of political science at UW-La Crosse. Anthony, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks so much for having me, Rob.
To start things off, how significant is this shift in the Supreme Court, big picture?
This is, big picture, a huge shift in the Wisconsin State Supreme Court. In fact, Rob, many observers had called this the most important election anywhere in the United States in all of 2023, and that's for good reason. You mentioned some of the important issues that the Wisconsin State Supreme Court could hear. One of the most important certainly centers on the 1849 abortion ban in Wisconsin. Wisconsin has one of the most restrictive abortion laws in the nation in the aftermath of the U.S. Supreme Court overturning Roe versus Wade. Janet Protasiewicz made abortion the centerpiece of her campaign, and the voters clearly responded to that. Now that case heads towards the Wisconsin State Supreme Court, and with a 4-3 liberal majority, we can make, I think, some pretty good predictions about how the abortion ban will fare when it goes before the Wisconsin State Supreme Court. Rob, you also mentioned gerrymandering. One more thing I would mention is the 2024 presidential election. Wisconsin could very well be the decisive state in the 2024 presidential election, and the Wisconsin State Supreme Court could be called on to hear many things related to that election, including voting laws, election administration, and the tabulation and certification of the votes. So looking ahead to 2024, this election has lots of relevance as well. This election lived up to the hype in terms of its importance, and this is a huge change for Wisconsin politics. As you said, Rob, it shifts the balance of power on one of the three branches of government, and that has a huge effect on Wisconsin politics more generally.
Now, the court isn't a legislature. The four members on August 1st can't just get together and say, okay, let's start changing laws. They have to wait for cases to work their way up to them. And the particular nature of those cases, the facts, the presentations, the legal history, that can put a brake on the court's ability to change things, even if they're temperamentally or judicially inclined to change them. Is there a limit as to how much they could change on some of these big issues?
There is a limit, and Rob, you mentioned the main limit, time. Time is the main limiting factor, in my view, for the change that the courts can make, because things do have to move through the judicial system, and sometimes that pace is not exactly a fast pace. But political scientists do observe predictable patterns in how judges view the cases. And so when the cases actually reach the Wisconsin State Supreme Court, or when the cases reach any court, as political scientists, we can make pretty reasonable predictions about how the justices will decide. And so I think the pace of change is something that people need to consider. But once those cases do reach the Supreme Court, I think in many cases we can make some pretty strong predictions about how they might turn out. And so change won't happen overnight, but change will certainly happen in some very important areas as a result of this election outcome.
Another set of laws that people I've seen hope or fear might change under this court goes back to the Scott Walker era, the Act 10 reforms on public employee unions, right to work, so-called laws on private employee unions, things like that. The thought that new legal challenges might emerge to parts of those laws and find a more sympathetic state Supreme Court. Is that something you might expect to happen?
I do expect that to happen, Rob, and that is because this is the first time in 15 years that we have seen a liberal majority on the Wisconsin State Supreme Court. So you can imagine that there is, let's just say, a backlog of cases that might have been issued, that might have been put against some of those laws, but haven't because of the prospect that a conservative court would rule a certain way. But now with a liberal majority on the Wisconsin State Supreme Court, there are going to be some opportunities at hand for those who might want to challenge particular laws. And so the fact that we now have a change for the first time in 15 years in the balance of power means that there are going to be a lot of people seeking to get their case before the Wisconsin State Supreme Court.
Talking to Anthony Chergosky, political scientist at UW-La Crosse, looking at the balance of power in Wisconsin politics, what changes with a change at the State Supreme Court after this week's elections. You can join in with your thoughts, your hopes and fears, your questions at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller. Robert is with us in Eau Claire. Robert, hi.
Yeah, hi. Good to hear you. My question, or I'd like the observation of your guest with regards to the potential attempt to impeach Janet Protasiewicz when she had won by, I think, almost 200,000 votes or maybe more. I'm curious to hear what he would say the response would that to be. What would the response be if there was an attempt to impeach her?
I gotcha. Thanks for the call, Robert. Now, Anthony, as you know, we had a special state Senate election in Wisconsin. It restored a Republican 2/3 majority in the Senate. Impeachment laws, as I read them, a majority in the Assembly issues the impeachment. The Senate would have to vote in a 2/3 majority to completely impeach not just a judge, but a governor or any other civil officer of the state, I believe is the phrase. What are the prospects as you see them?
Well, first of all, Rob, it's an important reminder that while the Republican-friendly maps might be in jeopardy, those Republican-friendly maps are still in place. And so the Republicans enjoy overwhelming majorities in both the state assembly and the state Senate. As you mentioned, as a result of that key special election for the state Senate, Republicans have 22 seats in the state Senate, while Democrats only have 11 seats in the state Senate. So Republicans do have that 2/3 majority in the state Senate. Now, the leader in the Republican Party in the state Senate, Devin Lemahieu, poured some cold water pressure, let's just say, on those prospects of impeaching Janet Protasiewicz. He tried to tamp down the speculation about that. And frankly, I don't think it was helpful for the Republican Party to talk about impeaching someone who had yet to be elected. And I think Devin LeMahieu, the leader of the Republicans in the state Senate, understood that and tried to maybe reset the tone, reset the conversation, and try to steer the conversation away from the prospect of impeaching Protasiewicz.
Robert, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. Looking ahead to potential strategies and talking here about, again, those things like Act 10 reforms and right to work, the conservative group Institute for Reforming Government called for Republicans in a press release today to use the state constitution to protect Walker-era changes. I'm quoting from their press release. Conservatives need to meet the moment by going bold, as liberals will assuredly be doing, proposing amendments on topics like universal school choice, public union regulation, right to work, agency authority, and partisan gerrymandering claims. So the idea of using the state constitution to advance or cement some policy agendas. What do you think of that notion, Anthony?
It certainly is a possibility because it gets around the governor. The governor cannot veto constitutional amendments. They need to be voted on twice by the state legislature, and then they need to be voted on by the public. So it is a potential strategy to get around the Democratic governor, Tony Evers, and now to get around the majority for the liberals on the Wisconsin State Supreme Court. So I think Republicans are right now trying to figure out what their next move might be. They might be thinking about some course corrections that they could make in doing better in statewide elections. So I've heard Republicans talking about how they might become more competitive in statewide elections. And as you said, Rob, I've also heard Republicans talk about how they might achieve their policy goals in light of the fact that there is a Democratic governor now and soon to be a 4-3 liberal majority on the Wisconsin State Supreme Court. So I'm not surprised to hear the prospect of constitutional amendments come up in the conversation. As we've noted, that gets them around the courts and the governor and allows the people to weigh in on those amendments. But it is a high risk strategy because constitutional amendments are a big deal. And a constitutional amendment is something that has to be taken very seriously. And so while constitutional amendments have their place, I don't know that governing by constitutional amendment is a route that we want to go down. So constitutional amendments are a valid part of the political process in Wisconsin politics, but we have to be wary of their overuse or their misuse. And so I expect those to be the considerations that are relevant as we go down this road in Wisconsin politics.
And to distinguish, we had these bail constitutional amendments. We're planning to talk about those more on Monday on the show. But to change the bail system in ways that people wanted to, those were already defined in the Constitution. So that's a case where you couldn't legislate those changes without altering the Constitution, as I understand it. So that's a distinction to make between this idea of, say, putting Act 10 in the Constitution.
That's quite right, Rob. And so I think the appropriate use and the inappropriate uses of constitutional amendments are going to be a key topic in Wisconsin politics as the Republican majorities in the state legislature try to cope with this setback that they've faced, and as the Republican Party and the conservative movement more generally tries to chart out their next steps forward, having suffered this defeat in the Wisconsin State Supreme Court election.
Talking to Anthony Chergosky, Assistant Professor of Political Science at UW-La Crosse, with us today to look at this week's elections, what they could mean for big issues like abortion, redistricting, election law, and coming up, we'll get into what they might mean for the future of Wisconsin politics. And you could join in at 800-642-1234. What do you hope for or worry about in the new lineup, a liberal majority in the state Supreme Court? What do you think this week's elections mean, if anything, for the Republican Party, the Democratic Party, for nonpartisan elections? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk with Anthony Chergosky, Assistant Professor of Political Science at UW La Crosse. Following Tuesday's elections, we're looking at likely next steps for Democrats and Republicans in Wisconsin, what that can mean for our courts, the legislature, the governor's office, and you can join in at 800-642-1234. With the change in control in the state Supreme Court, effective August 1st, what are you hoping to see from that court on a big issue that's important to you? What are you hoping they don't change? What do you want to see from the party you lean toward, Republicans, Democrats, or a different party, when it comes to the next election cycle? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Back to your calls. Kathy is with us in Madison. Kathy, hi.
Well, hi. So I guess my question was how to get these constitutional amendments even on the ballot, because I'm still fighting for legalizing marijuana. It was on the ballot for just like a questionnaire, and we're like 73% of Wisconsinites want this. So they ignored it, the Republican legislation, and I'm a Democrat hardcore. So is that something the Democrats can go around and try to make a constitutional amendment on the ballot?
Kathy, thanks for the call. So Kathy had voted in a non-binding referendum there. These constitutional amendment referenda, as you mentioned, Anthony, it's a longer process. Remind us how that goes from idea to ballot.
Absolutely, Rob. It takes two votes by the legislature, and then it goes to the voters. So the governor does not weigh in on this issue of a constitutional amendment. The governor does not have veto power. Now, I have some bad news for Kathy. The Republican-controlled legislature has declined to take up the issue of marijuana legalization. And right now, the Republicans are even sorting out some internal divisions surrounding medical marijuana. So that is not a constitutional amendment that we are likely to see. We are likely to see talk of conservative constitutional amendments that may not get the approval of Governor Evers, so they want to work around the veto. And they also may want to work around this new 4-3 liberal majority on the Wisconsin State Supreme Court. So as we've talked about, Rob, as the conservative movement tries to pick up the pieces and chart a new way forward, we're likely to hear more talk of these constitutional amendments and other strategies that conservatives and Republicans might use as they move forward following this setback in Tuesday's election.
Thanks a lot for that call, Kathy, at 800-642-1234. Anthony, I want to ask you what you think about the political meaning of this week's election results, what it could mean for the future, with the caution that, you know, in 2008, Barack Obama and Democrats swept the table here in Wisconsin. And in 2010, Scott Walker and the Republicans did exactly the opposite. So it can be hard to learn lessons like that. That said, what are you looking at?
Yeah, we know that it's dangerous to read too much into any one election in Wisconsin. We know that Wisconsin politics can be wild and wacky, and so we don't want to draw too many conclusions from any single election. But there are some important conclusions we can draw, in most notably trends from past elections that seem to have continued into this election, Rob. One that I want to note is the suburbs of Milwaukee and some other suburbs around Wisconsin. We have been watching those suburbs very closely throughout the Trump era because the suburbs, particularly the suburbs of Milwaukee, used to be the heart and soul of the Republican Party, used to be the heart and soul of the conservative movement. In the Trump era, the base of the Republican Party has really drifted into those rural parts of Wisconsin, and the urban areas of Wisconsin have moved much more into the Democratic Party camp. That has meant that suburban areas are the new battlegrounds in Wisconsin. And we saw suburban areas continue their shift towards the Democratic Party and towards Democratic Party aligned candidates. We saw that with Janet Protasiewicz on Tuesday. We also saw a massive voter turnout in Dane County and a massive margin for Janet Protasiewicz in Dane County. She got over 80% of the vote in Dane County. She got almost 200,000 votes out of Dane County. And so the Republicans have a huge Dane County problem when it comes to the urban-rural split. Republicans are running up huge margins in rural Wisconsin, but Dane County is a fast-growing part of the state in terms of population. And just as Dane County continues to grow in population, it continues to deliver larger and larger margins for Democratic candidates. So, Rob, those would be the trends that I think are continuing into this week's election from past elections, that urban-rural split and the suburbs continuing their drift into the Democratic Party fold.
Back to our callers now. Leanne is with us in Madison. Leanne, hi.
Hi. This is a historical question, which shows you I haven't been keeping up with my history over the years. But to your guest, have we seen in the past this kind of intentional ideology pursuit and, you know, stay in power pursuit, and who cares about what's best for the people or what they really want?
Interesting question, Leanne. I think often we have a sense like politics now is bad. We did better in the past. Anthony, is there anything to that?
Yeah, there is something to that in the sense that we have historic polarization, historic partisanship, and that's why every election seems like the most important election ever. And it's frequently said in Wisconsin that, hey, this election is the most important one in our lifetimes. But that can be true for every election if the political divide keeps growing, if the level of partisanship keeps growing, and as the stakes keep increasing. And so we get a little tired in Wisconsin, perhaps, of hearing that, hey, this election's the most important one ever. But this election really, really did matter, and it correctly got nationwide attention due to the high stakes.
Thanks for that call, Ann. Jim is with us now in Cedarburg. Hi, Jim.
Thanks, Rob. To your guest, the election brought in more money than, you know, in historical highs. But my question is about what was Scott Walker's contribution to allowing that dark money to come into our political campaigns? That's my question.
Jim, thanks for the call. Anthony, we know there are big U.S. Supreme Court rulings that allowed money into politics in different ways. We had some changes here in Wisconsin as well. How significant were they?
They were very significant, Rob. The money worked in a couple ways, and the money worked in different ways on different sides. For Janet Protasiewicz, she got huge amounts of transfers from the Democratic Party. Political parties in Wisconsin are allowed to transfer unlimited amounts of money to candidates. And Protasiewicz got millions and millions and millions of dollars from the Wisconsin Democratic Party. The Wisconsin Democratic Party is a money-raising machine. They do exceptionally well when it comes to fundraising, and Protasiewicz absolutely benefited from that. Protasiewicz had a pretty solid spending advantage throughout this campaign. But the spending advantage did close a bit because some outside groups came in to support the Dan Kelly campaign. Fair Courts America, a super PAC backed by GOP megadonor Dick Uihlein, and Wisconsin Manufacturers and Commerce, the powerful business group in this state. They spent pretty lavishly, honestly, to support Dan Kelly. And so both sides had quite a bit of money. The money was very different, though. With Protasiewicz, it was money that she had raised from kind of small dollar grassroots donors, plus these huge transfers from the Democratic Party, while Dan Kelly was very reliant on that outside PAC money in order to keep his campaign afloat.
Thanks for that call. Anthony, a lot of our callers over time have been concerned about the amount of money in elections, especially judicial elections. Do you think that that does have a damaging effect on the kind of campaigns we see?
I think it's a conversation that we have to have, Rob, because it would be one thing if we only slightly broke the record for most spending in a judicial election in American history. But we absolutely shattered the existing record for most spending on a judicial election in American history. The previous record was $15 million, and we basically tripled that record this time around. So I think there for sure is a conversation to be had about campaign finance, particularly in the context of judicial elections, as we assess the aftermath of this Tuesday's election.
Anthony, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you.
Anthony Chergosky is an assistant professor of political science at UW-La Crosse. He was with us today to talk about the shifting balance of political power in Wisconsin, what it might mean for politics and policy in our state in the months and years to come. Coming up, we'll take a closer look at nonpartisan elections here in the state, and we're starting to touch on that, why they feel more and more partisan these days. Money, probably part of that story. Coming up tomorrow on The Morning Show with Kate Archer-Kent, unions are getting a lot of attention in recent years, but union membership hasn't bounced back to historic levels. Kate talks to the head of a national teachers union, and you could join the conversation with your thoughts, your questions, maybe your experiences in a union. That's tomorrow morning at 8 here on the Ideas Network.